Since I was not going to actually die, the grand effect of my life review was to show me that I had the ultimate choice in my life. I was free to choose what I may. However, my choices would either take me to the light or leave me in darkness. I also learned that our lives are recorded somewhere, detail upon flawless detail. Everything we do matters. Nothing is just trivial. It is all profoundly significant, and life is meaningful and full of purpose. I learned to not minimize what is going on in my life. I try to see everything I do as being of eternal worth. I learned and have trained myself to believe that I am not just a simple person with little worth or impact upon the world. Everything we do has import, and God is involved in the details of our lives. I believe you can go so far as to say that He is in the minute details of our lives. I used to think God was a stern and divine parent who just sent us to earth and said, "Go to it, and we'll see how you did after you die." But the truth is that for Him and His angels, we are truly His work and His glory. We are what He is doing. We are what He is about. I learned that families, brothers and sisters, cousins and aunts and uncles have divine purpose in those affiliations and connections. Even though it might be easy to criticize or ignore people, in truth, those connections are all purposeful. I learned that there is truly a return and report system in our present life, which we don't use properly. I recommend that we get used to doing this in our daily and family prayers and in our relationships, that we practice returning and reporting. This is what you asked me to do today. This is what I did, and this is what happened. And then plead for eternal intervention in the details. I learned that our entire existence is this way. God gives us some element necessary for our journey, even before we were born. Then He gives us time to explore and experience life, and then He requires us to report. Now He has given us a body and a mortal experience, and we will all be required to report. The accounting of our lives will be in great detail, for our very bodies tell the story of our lives. Every part of us has written upon it all we do, believe, and are. The Lord can read all of this in its entirety. He can and will read us like a book, for it is all within us, written on our very bones, hearts, and sinews. Dispensational priority and purpose. Finally, I learned that there is a dispensational priority and purpose for why we are here at this time. It is not random. It is not accidental. It is divinely engineered, and when we make our final reporting, we will again see all the reasons why we came to earth now, and the interacting purposes and covenants that we made, that sent each of us to earth at our specific time and place to do specific things. To us mortals, this is a misty concept, but to God, it is an exact science, divine math, if you will. He records every act of our lives, including His continuing guidance, which most of us ignore. We spend so much time entertaining and pleasing ourselves that we do not fully realize how important every moment and every interaction truly is to God. Most of us are trapped in our own lives of business and pleasure, so much so that we don't even feel the hand of God directing our lives, nor do we hear His voice, which is constantly directing us. All of this information came to me very quickly as I stood there, watching the doctors try to resuscitate my body. All of these things were going on simultaneously, and I could focus upon them all. Visiting my wife as a spirit. I became aware of my wife sitting out in the waiting room. She had been reading a magazine at the moment the PA system began blaring, "Code Blue, Code Blue." Lynn began to worry about me, fearing that it was me that was in trouble. I knew she was worried in the same way I knew everything about the nurses and doctors. I wished to be near her, and I was instantly standing beside her. I apparently moved at the speed of thought. I don't recall walking or moving through walls. I was just there. My complete attention went to her, though doing so did not diminish my understanding or complete attention to what was still happening around my body. I knew I had come through two walls to be in the waiting room with her, but I did not experience passing through them. I found myself standing right next to her. I could tell everything about her. I knew exactly what she was feeling and thinking. I knew what she had been reading in the magazine she had just placed on her lap. I was concerned and wishing someone would come tell her that I was okay, that I was not the one having the cardiac arrest. I thought, here I am. I'm dead and out of my body, and I can't even communicate with you." I felt empathetic for her fear and pain, but it struck me as a dilemma, even a bit funny. I could see her and hear her thoughts, but I couldn't talk to her in a way she could understand. I remember thinking, "How am I going to let you know that I am all right, even though I am no longer living?" I began to wonder if she would be able to sense me or hear me, perhaps, if I moved through her. I asked her in my mind if I could have her permission to move through her. Even though she was not aware of me, her spirit answered, "Yes." I instinctively knew I had to have permission to do this. I understood this, but I am not sure why or how. It wasn't until later that I began to understand that entering another person's body is very invasive, and a righteous spirit always seeks permission if it is ever necessary. Evil spirits wait for opportunities when we are spiritually weak, or after we have rendered ourselves vulnerable by disobedience to God's laws, and then they enter into us in an act of spiritual violence. After her spirit responded that I could, I moved through her, and I immediately understood the difference between her physical body and her spiritual body. Her physical self had no realization that I was interacting with her. Her spiritual self, however, was fully aware of me and what I was trying to do and say. The problem was that, like most mortals, she was only aware of her physical body, captive to it, so to speak, and not in tune with her spirit at that time in her life. I realized that moving through her was of no advantage to my trying to communicate with her. As I passed through her, I learned many things about what her experience in mortality had been like, what it felt like to be a woman, to be loved, to be protected, and now to be fearful for her protector. I understood her completely, including what it was like to have our sons and daughters, and how hard it was to live with my illnesses and struggles. Angels Among Us. Lynn was sitting in a crowded waiting room. After I passed through her to no effect, I began looking around the room. I could see that there were many spirit persons in the room, along with the mortals that were there. The mortals looked really different from the spirit people. Mortals are solid-looking and appear to be completely unaware of anything spiritual going on around them, almost rendering them unintelligent-looking. Spirit people are semi-transparent. I could see through them to some extent, and they seemed to be aware of me and the other spirits in the room. Some were not happy that I could see them, but nonetheless continued interacting with mortals and other spirits as they went about their purposes. All of the spirit people I saw were surrounding mortals, observing them or trying to gain their attention so they could influence them in some way. There were other spirits walking in and out of the waiting room. I could see them, and they could see me. They sometimes acknowledged my presence or walked around me instead of through me. There were spirits there who did not realize yet that they were dead, or they refused to accept it. These were quite peculiar to me, for they tried their best to act like a mortal, even though it was clear to me and every other spirit present that they were dead. I could understand why they didn't know they were dead. Being dead and being a disembodied spirit is a real existence. You still think like you did. You still love and hate just like before your death. You can see people, spirits, and your own body. You can touch spiritual things and spirit beings and feel them. So it is a real and concrete form of existence, even though mortal beings, like walls and furniture, can be seen and sensed, but cannot be manipulated by spirits. I am not sure if every spirit had the same spiritual perception I did, but I knew their new lives were real to them, even more real in some ways, because they could come and go to places very quickly, and walk through walls and do things mortals can hardly imagine. Being newly disembodied did not feel like the death they'd expected to experience, where you just become unaware or non-existent forever. So to them, they were not dead by their previous understanding of what constitutes death. These spirits were gathering around mortals, talking to them as though they thought the mortals were listening to them. But the mortals were completely unaware of them, just as my wife was unaware of me. These disembodied spirits were trying to get the mortals' attention by various actions, including shouting at them. These spirits were dressed like normal mortals. They had little glory around them. I began thinking of them as recently disembodied spirits. Those spirits who had recently died maintained the look, manner of dress, and shape they had while they were mortal, because they seemed to still not believe they were dead. One male spirit was speaking to a young woman who appeared to be his daughter. He was upset about his business and how she was handling it. He was shouting at her, "You need to listen to me. but she had no idea that he was even there. He acted like she was just ignoring him, and this seemed to infuriate him even the more. He was demanding that she do certain things with his business and his property, and that he was perturbed about whatever it was she was doing wrong by his thinking. There were other spirits there who had embraced their altered state and had entered into God's employ to do his work according to his will. These angels had been sent back by God to assist their loved ones through this difficult time. These angels had a recognizable glow about them, which told me instantly that they were good and on an errand from God. These good angels were dressed differently. Some angels wore robes, while others wore old-fashioned clothing typical of when they had lived. They were there to assist the mortals with things that were happening. Some were sent to assist and prepare mortals for their own death. They were speaking comforting words, giving instructions, and teaching. Even though the mortals seemed unaware of their helpers, if they were listening with their hearts, they were comforted, and they began to glow the same as the angels who were assisting them. Some of these good angels were there to minister to the spirits who could not accept their own death. These angels were dressed in white robes and were glorious to look upon. They were following the disembodied and confused spirits, speaking to them when they could get their attention, and enfolding them in their glory. They had joy in their labors and purpose in their actions. They were there by commission of Jesus Christ. I understood that all of these angels were family to those to whom they had been sent. Some were recent ancestors, like parents or grandparents. Others were from long ago. I was just new at observing spirits, and since that time I have learned a great deal more about them and how they work. I know now that there are definite classes of angels and levels of righteousness among the angels. This is visible to the eye when one is familiar with spirit beings. Just as I could tell everything about the doctors and nurses who were working on my body, I could tell everything about each of these spirits. That is how I knew they were family members. I learned that once you are born, your spirit takes the shape of the body it is born into and honors that shape because it was given to them by God. Even though they can change shape or appearance if God desires it, they always return to their natural shape, which is the shape of their former bodies. I also learned that the greater angels, those with more glory and greater power, can withhold their identity, so that someone like me, with little experience, could not know what their mission was, who they were, or anything about their history. I met a few of these greater angels in the waiting room as they were administering to their charges. There were also evil spirits in the room. They were there to tempt mortals, disrupt the work of the angels, and to cause any harm they could. These spirits had no light about them at all, but seemed to emanate darkness. These evil spirits were not readable to me. I knew some things about them, but not their identity or history. They gave me a bad feeling even to look at them. They seemed to be able to change their shape to morph into some other shape if they desired. I realized that a spirit who has never been mortal has no definite spiritual shape. I saw some of these evil spirits appear as a child, others as a man in a business suit or a beautiful young woman. It became evident to me that the unborn spirits could choose their shape, just as Satan did in the Garden of Eden by appearing in the shape of a snake. This was the first time I realized that spirits, who never receive a physical body, had the ability to appear any way they chose. They could take on the appearance of a living individual if it helped them to deceive or to fulfill their assignments. They could appear in the image of a grandfather, a dead prophet, or someone's wife if it helped them in their deception. They are out to do great harm as much as they can, and they did not like it that I could see them. Most of the evil spirits were there on assignment. They were trying to create fear, confusion, and distress, anything that kept the mortal they were assigned to from hearing the message from the angels of light who were also there. Not only did they speak to the mortals to afflict them, but they laughed and mocked them and delighted in their pain and fear. If they could have convinced another mortal to stand up and torture or torment their assigned target, they would have done so in an instant. They were evil beyond any definition of evil I had before understood. Most of these evil spirits were there by commission from their master. They were not just out wandering the earth looking for mischief to do. When they realized that I could see them, they moved away from me, sometimes vanishing and reappearing in a different part of the room. I realized I could communicate with them, but I had little desire to do so, and they refused to do any more than glance at me before they moved away. The good angels, the ones that glowed with light, acknowledged me with a nod or smile and sometimes allowed me brief glimpses into what they were doing there in that waiting room, but then they quickly returned to their assignment. I knew the evil spirits could see me because they avoided me. But the disembodied spirits, the dead who refused to acknowledge their own death, did not even seem to see me, nor did they attempt to communicate. I believe they could see me because several of them stepped around me, but they did not talk to me, similar to how people act in this world around one another. I met spirits in that experience in the hospital that day who had not learned this simple lesson of the eternal worth of their own lives. They were still trying to protect their possessions, businesses, and bank accounts, and ensure that their things were still theirs. They were hanging around living people, refusing to move on to the next part of their own journey because they had never learned to trust God and sacrifice their worldly possessions in obedience to God's will for them. They would not acknowledge or talk to the angels sent from God to help them move on to their new lives. They didn't even seem to see them, although I could see and hear them plainly. I could see that before their death, these people had not learned to hear or acknowledge the direction God gave them while they were living, and after their death, that deafness to God's guidance persisted. The same blindness and obstinacy and disobedience of mortality simply followed them into the world of spirits. We should perhaps ask ourselves, have we accomplished what we came to earth to do? The other side is constantly intervening to help us learn what we need to learn so that we can accomplish our life's mission. We are sent here to accomplish our own work, to heal the wounds of past generations, and to bless those who follow us. The evil spirits are constantly attempting to derail us from our ordained path. During all of this time, seeing and understanding these various spirits in the waiting room, I remained aware of what was going on with my body in the procedure room. The doctors and nurses were still working feverishly on me. They injected my heart with epinephrine, and my body started to revive. I could feel it calling to me, demanding that I return to it. I left my wife and walked back down the hallway they had taken me through initially. A voice other than my own informed me that I needed to get back to my body quickly. I said to myself, "I need to get back to my body," and turned to walk through the wall into the procedure room. They were still working on me, trying to revive me. I found myself going through a process that felt similar to when I left my body, but it was not ready, and I found the experience excruciating. I tried to remain in it, but it was horrifyingly painful. I exited my body the same way as before, out of the bottom of the table, and around to standing beside my body. The doctors were still doing CPR and working on me. The Ministry of Angels. I looked around and saw three individuals in the room standing opposite to me, across from my body. They were looking at me, not at my body, but directly at me, with expressions of great interest. The two on the left and right were angels who had once been mortal and who were now accompanying the spirit between them, who had not yet been born. I knew instantly that they were training him. The angel on the left was a thin man with a kind of goatee beard about 3 inches long, as white as snow. I knew that he had lived well into his 80s. Because of the ability I have explained of knowing everything about other spirits and mortals while in that state, I knew who he was. The angel on the right was a younger man. He had lived on earth later than the first angel. Both of these angels were progenitors of mine. They did not identify themselves, but I knew that they were blood relatives. They were there protecting the life of my body on the operating table. These two older angels did not appear concerned and did not show much emotion. They both had white hair and the aura of wisdom, light, and righteousness. The young man in the middle was a full head taller than the other two angels. He was slender but strong-looking. He had no beard. His hair was dark. He had piercing brown eyes and an aura of gentleness. He had not yet been born, but I felt his profound love for me, which flowed from him into my soul. He was very concerned for me in this emergency situation and did not possess the other two angels' confidence and serenity. The three angels were speaking to one another non-verbally. I could hear them. The teaching angels were comforting the younger one. "It's fine. Everything's fine. No need to be concerned. We are here to ensure Spencer returns to his body. Have faith." All three of these men manifested love and concern for me. I knew that they were there for me, and I was their concern and their business, and that I was family to them. When I finally returned to my body, I was not allowed to remember their identities, but I believe I have identified all three individuals through family photos in the genealogy in my possession. The angel on my left was James Henry. He is my great-great-grandfather. The angel on the right was his son, Harold Henry, my great-grandfather. They look exactly like their old photos. The unborn spirit in the center was my unborn son, Spencer Jr. I wasn't able to identify my son Spencer until he grew into his late teens, and I realized one day that he looked exactly like the center angel. Counting myself, there were four generations of family in that room. As I was looking at them, I was given to understand that it is a family responsibility to serve as ministering angels. It is a family responsibility to heal, teach, minister to, protect, and preserve the family connections and covenantal relationships in the spirit realm and in the mortal world. This is their first responsibility as departed spirits. Until that work is done, until the family relationships are preserved and sealed, other things must wait. They were at the hospital to assist me because my mortal work was not finished, and in a way that I could not understand until much later in my life, my continued life was important to our family and to them personally. My unborn son was particularly invested in my continuing mortality, but there was much more to his concern than his birth. He was acting out of his love of the Savior, and under his guidance, was there to be with me in my time of need. In the world of departed spirits, the teaching of the gospel to past generations must come from righteous souls who acquired it during their lives. In other words, you must acquire the gospel here on earth before you can be a missionary and minister to those who departed before you who, for whatever reason, did not embrace the gospel during their mortal lives. This is one of the reasons the righteous departed are welcomed with such joyful reception in heaven, because some of these earlier generations have been waiting a long time for a descendant of theirs to embrace the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because of this, the spirits of the dead are excited for us to receive the gospel ordinances and authority and then complete our mortal lives and return so we can teach them and bring the gospel blessings to them on that side of the veil. Even though we are only dimly aware of how the gospel works on that side of the veil, there is almost a mirror image there of everything we do here. Every ordinance we attempt to bestow here has a corresponding ordinance on that side of the veil. We speak of the departed as accepting or rejecting our labors in their behalf. Their acceptance constitutes an ordinance in their world. It is one of the great urgencies of that world to keep up with the work going on here in mortality. The timetable is advancing so quickly that the righteous dead are often in a great hurry to complete their assignments, and they have little time to pay a lot of attention to small matters. In the great circle of things, most blessings given to mortals also come from their righteous dead. When we pray for a great blessing, need, or healing, Jesus Christ sends our righteous progenitors as ministering angels to deliver the blessing. If we have no righteous forebearers, then the blessings must be attended to by other righteous workers there, of whom there is short supply. Any angel who is able to deliver these blessings works first with their own families, and then goes on assignments to bless others. This means that our blessings may be delayed in coming or seem to arrive just barely in time. They are busy working to establish the relationships and to protect and bless them. Deceased family are watching and waiting and guiding us into fulfilling our righteous mortal duties so that we can return and teach and bless them. I also learned that it is a great blessing to have been born into a family where those who have died before were righteous, powerful men and women, sealed in covenant relationships generation after generation. They have greater power to bless and guide mortals. I was told to try to go back into my body. I'm not sure if it was the three angels who instructed this or my own thinking, but I rose up and tried again and found myself rejected in a tremendously painful way. I am quite sure that if spirit bodies could be injured, that experience would have done me great harm. As it was, I was unharmed and had no lingering pain except for the memory of it. Again, I found myself standing beside the procedure table, looking down at my body. The power of the fall. One of the most profound realizations I had in this experience was to see the difference between my spirit body and that sick body lying there on the table. This was the first time that I had experienced the juxtaposition between my spiritual self and that mortal self. I was aware of the growth that my mortal body was lacking in order to reach the potential of my spirit self. My spirit was eternal, intelligent, perceptive, and powerful. My body was broken, subject to death, mentally slow compared to my spirit, unaware of almost everything spiritual and weak in every possible way. It was then I began to realize how far we mortals have fallen. I learned that we were different from how we were before the fall. Looking down on my body, I knew everything about it, how much time it needed, and how much growth and exposure to truth it needed in order to be finished or completed, to be able to receive all that the Father had prepared for it to receive. That was quite clear to me. I understood all the changes my body needed to experience to become fit to return to the presence of the Father, and it seemed almost impossible to accomplish everything in the short duration of mortality. This first experience out of my body created the recollection and refreshed my memory of who I was and who I might become through obedient choices. I then made a commitment, a covenant you could call it, between myself as a spirit and my body, that I would do everything that I had to do to allow my body to receive every change and upgrade and sanctification it needed in order to return to Father with me inside it. While just in my spirit, I was pure, complete, knowledgeable, and I knew exactly who I was and where I came from. My spirit was in the image of God, and I knew this clearly. A spirit does not have a complete veil of forgetfulness when it is liberated from the body. I knew that I came from the Father and had the full potential to become like the Father. When I was in my spirit self, I was all these things, and there was no question or uncertainty about anything. My spirit only wanted to do the will of God and nothing else. But in the body, I was handicapped by spiritual blindness and moral weakness, and I was blinded by the screaming demands of the flesh. I was full of questions, uncertainty, pride, corruption, self-will, and desires for evil. Worst of all, I could remember nothing of my prior life with Father. I didn't even have a clue who I really was. The contradiction between my two identities was overwhelming and paralyzing. I understood that this disparity was all a result of the fall of man, and that I had to overcome those things by obedience to Christ's gospel and laws. In the next experience out of body, which I will tell about later in this book, I saw all of the sorrows and trials and struggles I needed to go through to refine that mortal body in order to actually arrive at the state I had just promised I would achieve. In all honesty, after seeing all the trials I would go through, I couldn't see how I would ever make it. My ego was washed away because I immediately knew I couldn't do it in any way except by the full and unending grace of Christ. It had to be a miracle of the atonement, because I knew my weaknesses too well to think I, or any mortal for that matter, was strong enough to do it alone. Finally, in my last out-of-body experience, I was shown the end result of that journey, when and how I would eventually triumph over all these things, keep all of my covenants, obey all of the commandments, and finally bring my body back into the presence of Christ. Having overcome the fall, being redeemed by Christ, then it was ready to fulfill our mission, our meaning my spirit and body, in the latter days. Previous to these experiences, I had no idea that there was a distinct preparation for my body. I thought I was my body, and I was growing through my experiences. I learned that I am in fact my spirit self, who already has a godly nature, and rather than overcoming my body, as in beating it into submission, my struggles were engineered to elevate my body to the stature of my spirit. I will get back to these other experiences later on. At this point, I was still outside of my body in the hospital, waiting for my spirit to re-enter my body. Exploring the hospital. I decided I had a little time before my body would be revived. I expected it to be revived, mostly because of the confidence and words of the three angels standing there near my body, and because I had not been called away from the hospital. I had not seen a tunnel of light, or a heavenly messenger as I had actually expected I would. So I just assumed my destiny was to survive somehow and live on. Time for a spirit moves differently than for a mortal, and even if it was just a few mortal minutes, I had time to explore this amazing situation of being out of my body. I decided to experiment and have a look around. I know that might sound frivolous or that I didn't care about my mortal life. The truth is, I loved my life, my wife and my children, all of it, and I was not hoping to die. But another truth is that I had been sick and in pain for a long time, and being out of my body was a great relief. I felt great peace and a total absence of fear. Each time I had tried to return to my body, I found it to be horrifyingly painful. There just aren't words in the English language that would make it possible for me to say how excruciating it was. My body was very, very sick, and as I moved into it, I could feel that sickness and pain beginning to again overwhelm me. But even more than that, it was kind of like being squeezed through a very small opening under high pressure. The process of re-entering the body was agonizing all by itself, and the fact that it was sick and in pain made the whole experience the most unpleasant of my whole life so far. So with this keen ability to perceive everyone's thoughts, even their history and future, and with a naturally curious mind, I thought I might as well enjoy the few minutes I might have until my body called for me to try again. Until then, I had no plan to attempt it of my own volition. I had already experienced walking through walls and was curious to experience that again. I felt comfortable doing this because I continued to be completely aware of what my body was experiencing, no matter where I was in the hospital. I turned away and walked to the nearest wall, paused a moment, and then stepped through into the next room. I found myself in a doctor's office, having walked through a wooden desk, a wooden chair, and a leather couch. Hearing the woods and rocks. I paused for a moment to let the flood of information settle into my mind. As I passed through the desk, I realized that it had been made from three different trees. I saw each tree. I knew them from the moment their seed germinated until they were harvested, milled, and crafted into this desk. There was a living component in the wood. It was intelligent but had little will. It was content to be wood, and it was pleased that someone had chosen it to be shaped into this desk. It was a roll-top desk and quite beautiful. I knew that the desk understood the love the craftsman had put into his work on the desk. The desk also felt pure and worthy, because it had never been used in anything that offended God. I want to say much more about this phenomenon of understanding physical things, but words fail me. I understand the emotion and motive of the man who cut it down, and knew his name, and all about his life too, as I did everyone who ever touched or used the desk. I understand everything about the cotton stuffing in the seat and the leather from the sofa. All of it welcomed me and was pleased to communicate to me its life and how it had come to be that couch. I understood the several cattle whose hides covered the couch and their lives and their sacrifice. They had left all that information with their hides, but the spirit of the cow was elsewhere, not in the leather. Although still pleased and content with the benefits to mankind that its life and sacrifice had rendered, it was pleased that it was a benefit to the children of Adam. The purpose of things. I might sum it up this way. All things on this earth are placed here for the purpose of bringing to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. Some things are here to feed us, some to comfort us, some to create beauty, shelter, even medicine. Some things are here to bring opposition, pain, and discomfort. But they are all here to create this world that exalts man. All of it is God's plan, and no part of it is dispensable. Even mosquitoes and viruses are part of the plan. My experience with all of these non-human things was that they are pleased that they are fulfilling the measure of their creation, and that the reward for doing so is acceptable and delightful to each of them. It was stunning to realize that life is so much more intricate than we can imagine or envision while in this mortal body. God has provided a complex and inspired system to exalt us. The big part of it is to give us the opportunity to be in a body that desires almost everything contrary to God's plan. Jesus Christ exposes us via the Holy Ghost to all that is true, speaking to our spirit every time we must choose between good and evil. Then when we sin, we can repent and obey His laws to let the atonement work for us. All of this process is designed by God to bring our spirit with our body into compliance with the laws of God, and to return body and soul, inseparably connected, back to the presence of God to be judged, to report back. Our premortal glory. It was intriguing to me to see that our spirits came to this earth in an almost godlike state. I expect there are some spirits that came here with impure motives and desires, but I found that my spirit only desired good, only desired to be in harmony with God. It was my body that was the slave of mortality, desiring things which were contrary to God's plan for me. When my spirit was placed in my body at birth, and it lost all of its memories of my long and good life before birth, it fell, or became subject to the fall of man when it entered my body. The big part of the purpose of mortality is to be cut off from God, thereby being forced to learn to listen to the voice of Christ and to overcome our body's mortal pull. In the same process, we are also learning to perfect it, to teach it perfect obedience to the will of Christ, and in so doing, to overcome the world and the fall. To me, one so inexperienced in the deep and divine things of the spiritual world, all of this was delicious to me. I was thrilled to experience these things and felt love coming from everything I touched, even the rocks, leather, and wood. I delighted in the love I felt flowing from myself back into them. It seemed that everything that had been created by God had its story, and was pleased that I had been able to hear them. I only heard contentment and praise of God from these things. I found that man-made things, like steel and plastic, were harder to walk through and had no voice. I couldn't discern their story or their history. They were dead to me at that time. I learned later that they were a part of the living earth, but did not learn until much later how to experience the earth. I simply was not ready for it at that time, and was hardly prepared when it happened far into the millennium. Communing with a piece of wood is like having a puppy step on your toe, wagging its tail, welcoming you with its cute little soul and lovable personality. Talking with the earth is like having a planet land on your body, bearing the weight of a great, great intelligence, of a perfect knowledge and flawless memory of all good and evil that has existed on her face, and all of the cries of righteous blood sounding up through the centuries for justice, of immense sadness, godlike patience, and the most joyous rejoicing in its final deliverance. It is to stand face to face with a living, brilliantly intelligent being the size of a planet, who is both loving and angry, anxious and patient, having been true and faithful in all things. It is not something one can prepare for without great spiritual experience and divine preparation. I was quite interested in rocks and natural stonework, whose voice was ancient, predating the formation of the earth. It remembered its creation and luxuriated and rejoiced in being beautiful and useful to man. I found that I liked rocks. They all magnified Christ. I liked their company and sense of timeless patience and eternal worship of Christ. Now consider, if I could enjoy rocks, whose intelligence and agency is so limited and less divine, how much more profound and glorious are human beings, who are so much more than rocks, yet we don't value them except for what they might do for us. Every person you meet has been alive forever. They predate earthly creation and are gods in infancy. Yet we see them as clerks, doctors, friends, family, or even as enemies or a source of our trials. But we seldom see them as they are, potential gods. I saw this as a tremendous impediment to our own growth. It speaks to how far we've fallen because not so long ago, in the eternal scope of things, when we understood the plan far more clearly, and we understood the worth of every soul, we were becoming gods, with a small g, ourselves. In this life, in a mortal body that knows nothing of His plan for us, we resist God. What is His plan? It is to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. So everything we experience is designed to bring us further along that journey. Through this out-of-body experience, all of this information was infused into my spirit. Since then, the veil is thinner for me in some aspects. I can not only remember what God has shown and taught me in vision, but I have His revelatory voice to teach me every moment of my life, through the light of Christ and the voice of the Holy Spirit. Having both perspectives on the works of God has thinned the veil in many ways. While I was walking through the hospital, I met other mortals. Some were workers, others were doctors and nurses. I didn't see many patients, as I seemed to be in an administrative section of the hospital. Each of these mortals' lives was completely transparent to me, as if their very being, their every secret and truth and lie, was being broadcast by themselves to the whole world. For me, it was all revealed, and all of it was visible to me. I found it oppressive because I could see the trouble they had created for themselves. I could see every mistake as well as every good act they had done. I felt deep sadness for most of them and could hardly stand to meet another person after a while. I found that it was much more pleasant to experience wood and rocks than humans. I was intrigued by their intricate history, which each of them showed to me in the instant I touched them. I was drawn to their positive vibe and eternal makeup. A cry for justice. I found a few items in the hospital that were saddened by how they had been used by their owners. A few things that had been used in crimes or for violence or immoral purposes, and their voice included a cry for redemption and justice. It was not a shrill or piercing or unpleasant sound, but it was unending and carried the vivid details of the injustice. I knew that the object itself was not diminished or condemned, but it waited with patient expectation for the day of redemption. I walked through a wall and into a nice office. It was more nicely furnished than the others, with beautiful pictures on the walls and ornate wooden furniture. I considered going out the door to see whose office this was, but as I walked through a desk, I was stunned by what I felt. It was longing for redemption. I realized that recently a series of love letters had been written at this desk promoting an affair that would ultimately injure many people. I knew the content of every letter and the true emotion and manipulation of the writer, as well as the reaction of the reader. I moved away, not wanting to remain in the stream of torrid details. I went through the couch, and it likewise testified of the same affair and unrighteous events that had occurred here, some recently. I could not find any place in that beautiful office that was not saddened or offended or crying for redemption. Returning to my body. I was about to leave when I again felt the call of my body. Instantly, I found myself back in the procedure room, looking at my body. In all of my latter experiences of leaving my body, I rose up out of it. But for reasons I still don't understand, I left and re-entered my body from beneath during this experience. I suddenly found myself under the table, moving rapidly up through it and into my body from beneath. This time, it was more painful than any of the other times. The pain was being experienced by my body, but as I connected with it, I felt it all. I was still aware in my spirit self, which, as I described, has enhanced sensibilities. For a moment, I could feel both my spirit, as it was rocked and pounded by my body's pain, and the pain of my body. The shock of the pain from both sources was overwhelming. Then, an instant later, I was only aware of my body. I was back inside. I was not just waking up as if from anesthesia, but was fully conscious and aware of everything. I was sick, almost as sick as a mortal can be and still be alive. I had no strength to even blink my eyes. I was overwhelmingly nauseated, but too weak to vomit. My heartbeat was irregular, and I could feel sickness from all of the medications they had injected into me. I couldn't believe this was actually my body. It felt sicker than I had ever felt it. I felt body-burdened, as if my spirit wanted to fly out of it again, but my body was holding it down with a tremendous weight. I struggled to breathe. I could hear the nurses and doctors talking anxiously among themselves, and then to me. I opened my eyes. My perception of the passage of time was that I had been out of my body for 5 or 6 hours. I had seen and experienced so much and had wandered the halls of the hospital with no sense of needing to hurry, poking my head through closed doors and walking through every wall I could find. Yet when my eyes finally focused upon the clock on the wall of the procedure room, only 20 minutes had expired. It made no sense to me. I felt confused. They got me up and fed me some orange juice. I felt ill, so they told me to lie back down and rest. A doctor came and told me what had happened. He spoke of it all casually, like this happens all the time. He wanted me to come to his office for a while and rest to make sure I was going to be okay. I felt too weak, but they enlisted my wife, Lynn, to encourage me. She rolled me in a wheelchair to his office. She did not realize what had just happened. I recognized his office as the ornate office where the love affair had been enacted, but the office furnishings were silent, no longer speaking to my spirit, which was now apparently firmly back in my body. I told the nurse who stayed with us, "I've been dead." She shook her head and replied, "No, you just have had a hard time with the contrast, but now you are fine." She was reassuring, but she did not understand what I was trying to say. Everyone who spoke to us tried to minimize what had just happened. They didn't want to hear anything I had to say. In about half an hour, they told us I was fine and sent me home. Many different death experiences. A major part of this experience was that I began to understand agency and that people are having different experiences after death. This is something I certainly never supposed. Some people would not even admit they were dead. Other people, like myself, were just waiting for their bodies to be restored so they could re-enter them. These people were having experiences of many different types. Some were given the choice to return to mortality. I didn't seem to have a choice, as I was just called back. Some of the dead were met by angels of light, who accompanied them away from the hospital in a column of light. At the time, especially after I tried several times to re-enter my body, I considered them to be the more blessed ones. This out-of-body experience alone gave me decades of information to process and try to understand. Narrating this book is actually the first time in my life that I have tried to put all of these experiences into words. I have wondered, pondered, and prayed about them for most of my life, but this is the first time I have tried to describe them aloud. It is interesting to me to see how difficult it is, how few words there are to describe the true meaning of life, and what really happens when one dies. Back at home. A few days after we arrived home, I began to feel improved. I told Lynn about my out-of-body experience and about my visiting her in the waiting room. She was skeptical, though she found it inexplicable that I knew what magazine article she had been reading and that I could remember it up to the point that she had stopped reading when the speakers blared, "Code Blue, Code Blue." I told her everything, how she looked up and then stood up, how she was dangling the magazine from one hand, all of it. She confirmed to me that everything I said was actually true, though she could not bring herself to believe I had actually been dead for 20 minutes. She asked for an appointment with my doctor, and we both went. She demanded to know the truth of what had happened that day. The doctor would not admit that I had died. The only thing the doctor would say was that there were some scary moments when your heart stopped. You were not breathing, but we revived you. He completely minimized the experience and told us not to worry about it any further. I think what he was really saying was, "Please don't sue us."
Chapter 2. Paradise Lost. Rearranging My Life. I thought about these experiences every day thereafter, pondering them and what they meant. There were so many things that were contrary to my long-held beliefs, especially about my biological father and my birth. I carefully recorded these experiences in my journal. I also pondered daily how to change my life to conform to what God had just shown me. Before this, my life goal was to advance my career, to become a tenured professor, and to retire by the time I was 50. My goal was to become rich, to become well-known, to write books, and to become famous. I wanted to work in the church, serving in any capacity, working my way up through the priesthood, as I thought of it at that time, proving myself faithful and of service to the Latter-day Church. Following this experience beyond the veil, I spent the next 10 years rearranging my life from egocentric to Christ-centric. It was not an easy transition. I came to realize that almost all of my goals were misaligned with God's plan for me. I had been taught all my life to make money, raise a family, get known by the world, and then the Lord will use you in whatever way because you will be skilled, rich, and available. I'm not sure if previous to this experience I had subscribed completely to this goal in life, yet it is what I had been taught all my life by leaders, even by both of my mission presidents. It had never completely rung true to me, and now I knew why. Before this time, I had been of the mindset that I needed to get to a place in my life where God could know me, see my good works and my determination, and then He would know what I could do. After that experience, I knew that God already knew me, in great detail and far better than I knew myself. What He was teaching me in this experience was, "Spencer, you have it wrong. You need to learn to see yourself as I see you and know yourself as I know you, not the other way around. I already know all about you." Being out of my body and knowing without a doubt, with total surety, that there is a grand spiritual work and spiritual world that we can't see took me out of a circle that circumscribed only Spencer and expanded that circle of my understanding to include this unseen world of heavenly beings, including family members, angels, and Jesus Christ Himself. It changed me forever. As I mentioned before, It seemed to me as if the angels had left the door open into heaven. I continued to see people differently than before. I could see them to some extent through God's eyes. I could love them more, and the Lord sometimes sent me to help them in ways that would have been impossible otherwise. Miraculous ways, it might seem, if one did not realize that God's hand is always working in our lives. After this life-altering experience, I began getting information from God to give to my clients. I would upon occasion have to wait for them to stop talking so I could tell them what I had just learned. Over time, as I became more sensitive to spiritual things and more obedient in my response to them, my discernment improved. My insight into their lives improved. I sometimes saw and visioned the things that had happened to these clients, and my compassion and understanding was great for them. I couldn't help but be sympathetic. We are never alone. Another significant thing I learned was that we are never alone. Angels are always present, both good and evil. I also realized that by my behavior, mood, or thoughts, I was in control of who was in the room with me. I used to feel negative feelings or emotions and feel overpowered by them. I was startled to realize that I was dealing with dark spirits who overwhelmed me when I gave them permission by my emotions. I realized I was in control, and I worked hard to remain positive and loving, to invite divine beings into my life who uplifted me and those around me. It is a tenet of my faith now that for good or evil, we are never alone. I also realize that our agency is always honored, so much so that even though there are good angels around us, we still have to invite their intervention. We invite them to assist us by prayer, by having hope, by feeling faith and belief. Even the words we may think quietly or speak to ourselves, even these matter. Please show me how. Please help me. Please, God, help me find my keys. Please, God, save my children. All of these things trigger powerful things from the other side of the veil. They become even more powerful when we have learned to respond to these promptings of the Holy Spirit, because then we can be given the answers to these urgent prayers more quickly and profoundly. Every time God becomes involved in our lives, He is teaching and bringing to pass our eternal life. When God answers our prayers, He does so through angels, because the angels grow also. They learn what it is like to be like God, to serve and to relay God's answers to His children's prayers. This process is extremely orderly and divinely orchestrated. There is no happenstance or coincidence in their work. The good angels are subject to His command and limited or empowered by our faith. There are no oops moments when dealing with God or His messengers. Prayers are never not answered correctly due to an error on the other side. Everything happens as God directs. Redirecting my life. So now all of those worldly pursuits that I thought should define my life were taken away. I was shown that much of what I was trying to do was totally wrong for me. I was shown that it was the wrong pursuit. Stop it. I attempted to obey. I did complete my education and establish my career because I had seen that it was part of the right path for me. In my work, I often call upon Heavenly Father to let the angels that surround me and my client intervene. I do so with complete assurance that God hears me and the angels respond. Perhaps I have greater faith in this principle than most mortals because I have seen the angels. Before this time, I had worked in a large hospital with children suffering from cancer. There were times when I would see with spiritual eyes an angelic intervention to lengthen the child's life and knew it would happen. These times resulted in cures that could only be miracles of God. Upon occasion, I also realized that a child's life was at an end, and they had completed their mortal work. The child would pass away shortly thereafter. I would then have a great peace, knowing their lives were short but complete, which comfort I could pass on to their parents and family. At this time, I was home teaching a single sister with three children. This sister had brain cancer, and I wanted to cure her. I wanted to call upon the priesthood to heal her. She asked me to give her a blessing, but when I put my hands on her head, I was shown in vision that she should not live out the year. I didn't want to say so I gave her a blessing of comfort. But it was not the blessing I wanted to give her, nor was it the blessing Father had shown me He had in store for her. She turned to me after the blessing, with tears running down her face, and asked, "Why didn't you tell me what you saw? Why didn't you give me the blessing you saw?" I asked her what she meant. She said, "I saw the same vision you saw. I'm not going to live much longer than a year." I told her, "I was afraid to say it, afraid that it would discourage you and frighten your children." She replied, "Since it is God's will, it will help me to accept it. It is what I needed to see, even though you didn't say it out loud. I saw it with you, and I know it is true. Thank you for this blessing." She lived about 11 more months and then succumbed, leaving her 3 young children in the hands of family members. It was just one of many powerful experiences where my spiritual sensibilities and spiritual feelings were greatly enhanced. Unfortunately, I wasn't strong enough to speak the words properly, so Father showed this young mother the same vision I saw in her behalf. I learned much about my responsibility to do His work, even though fear tries to stop me from saying what has to be said. It is always the right thing to do. I tried from then on not to fear the emotions and concerns of men more than the will of God. After this out-of-body experience, my life went through a long and difficult evolution, especially when you consider that such decisions were not entirely mine, because these were my wife's and family's dreams as well. I had instilled my dreams into them for years, and now I was faced with trying to teach them why I had changed my life and my goals. These changes were not accomplished without resistance. Besides my family, almost all of my colleagues, fellow professors, and peers at the universities, even those who had mentored and advanced me at the universities, all resisted the changes I was making. Some of them viewed me as self-destructive, others viewed me as just stupid. There were even a few who told me that I had suffered a mental or emotional breakdown. I listened to all of these people, but decided to move forward with determination to do what I had been shown I must do. I left several of my hospital tenures, retired from several university appointments, and focused on my private practice. During this time of change, my health continued to degrade slowly. My immune system was compromised by surgery and many health problems. I had surgeries on my gallbladder, a burst appendix, and sinus surgery because I had continual sinus infections. I have had rheumatic fever twice, a heart murmur, and every cold and flu that came to town. It is my present realization that I set myself up for these illnesses by continuing the unhealthy emotional state which I acquired from childhood. I had not yet learned to not let those losses manifest themselves as physical illness. Also, I worked long and hard and didn't eat well. I didn't sleep enough. When I exercised, I worked out too hard or ignored exercise for long periods of time. The last and greatest reason for all of these health problems was that I was blessed to have health crises in order to experience physical death multiple times and thus to see these visions. I know now that before I was born, I chose this course for myself. I was glad to be able to choose this path for my life, and although it has been hard and painful and always terrifying, I still feel as if my life had been tremendously blessed because of this process in my life. I wouldn't go back and choose a different path, even if I could. By this time, Lynn and I had 5 children. My wife and children were doing well during these times, though we had the normal challenges of young families. Tahiti. After all of these medical challenges, career alterations, and family growth, my sweetheart and I decided to take a much-needed break from life and go on a vacation to Tahiti in March of 1995. We planned to go with Lynn's parents and her siblings. We all left our children home and were excited to get away. Lynn and I hoped to brighten our relationship, our dreams, and my health by total relaxation and rest in a tropical paradise. We took a long flight to Los Angeles and then to Honolulu. From there we flew to Tahiti. One of the curses that I have struggled with all my life is that I cannot fall asleep on an airplane. I arrived in Tahiti sleep-deprived after the 24-hour journey. We arrived on the island of Papeete, where the LDS temple is located. It was warm and beautiful on the island. A gentle tropical breeze was blowing. We boarded a boat and traveled to the nearby island of Moorea, to the small resort there. We arrived to find that the hotel was a series of charming huts, each consisting of one large room under a palm-thatched roof. The walls were open, with insect nets for walls. There was a single bathroom towards the back of the bungalow. The rooms were decorated with island art and paintings. It was completely charming. It was winter time back home, so we went from snowdrifts to an island paradise. I remember commenting that this was what Bali High in the musical South Pacific must have been like. there were towering purple volcanic mountains in the center of the island that sloped downward through lush vegetation to a beautiful park, which ended in perfectly white sand and intense, crystal-clear blue-green ocean. A coral reef protected the island from waves and from